Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. U.S.-Cuba relations may be changing, at least if the president has his way. This morning, we'll talk with Professor Aisha Nibi. She has a long relationship with Cuba and says most people hold opinions of it not necessarily based in reality. The lava flow is now very near Pahoa Marketplace. Today, Pahoa Auto Parts co-owner Brady Metcalf looks at the plan for his shop and for other businesses. On Friday, December 19th, it's The Conversation.
I'm Chris Vandercook, and you never know where a model rocket might lead you. If you build it right, hopefully it won't be to apologize for a broken window. This morning, Rocketeer Cole Santos considers the resurgent appeal of modern model rocket building. And if you're comfortable around horses, you know how a ride can be therapy. On Maui, that can help a child. The conversation starts right after the news.
Happy to start your Aloha Friday. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. NPR News just referred to a new chapter in U.S.-Cuba relations, and it's a chapter nobody's read yet, right?
Well, that's true, and it's one that we're not quite sure may happen in exactly the way that perhaps the president envisions, but it's certainly worth talking about. Now, you know that for over 50 years, the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba could be described with many words. Normal might not be one of them. This week, as you know, President Obama announced that he intends to open formal diplomatic ties with Cuba. That's drawing two opposite reactions and not much of either based on current firsthand knowledge, according to HPU Assistant Professor Aisha Nibi. Her academic interests aside, she has significant personal ties to the island, which puts her in regular contact with daily life in Cuba. She's made two extensive visits in 2009 and last year. And she joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
How did you come to be so deeply involved with Cuba?
So actually, I'm an anthropologist, and my field site is in northern Uganda. And so while I was doing my field research for my PhD, I met a Cuban in northern Uganda and became friends with him. And over the course of the next couple of years, I ended up becoming pretty close to the Cuban community in Uganda. And I came to understand that the Cuban government has a program of Cuban internationalism in which one of the things they do is they send doctors and professors and sports professionals overseas to basically fill in gaps in these countries in Latin America, in Africa, and other places. So I became close with the Cuban community in Uganda, and in the course of those relationships, I ended up sending my research assistant from Uganda to Cuba to study, because one of the other aspects of Cuban internationalism is that the Cuban government provides scholarships for students from Africa and Latin America and Asia to go to Cuba to study. And so I sent two kids from Uganda to Cuba to study, and they were both war orphans. And so I was kind of their mom through college. And so I was responsible to meet their needs outside of the tuition and, you know, the roof over their head. So in the course of that process over the last 6 years, I ended up being in very close contact and knowing, you know, every time a hurricane happens or any kind of political issues happen or, you know, changes in policies between the U.S. and Cuba, that would affect my ability to take care of them. So, you know, I became really kind of deeply attuned to the goings on, you know, on the island of Cuba.
And going there several times to have to take care of some of those issues.
Exactly.
So as you've had so much contact with them and recent contact, you were there last year, how is it that some of this has not sort of percolated through American consciousness, some of the things that Cuba has been doing, and that we seem to have very polarized ideas of Cuba that for a lot of people are based in history from over 50 years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that on both sides, both U.S. and Cuba sides, the government of Cuba and the, you know, U.S. media tends to tell certain stories about each other. And but I was surprised, actually, when I was in Africa to see the way that Fidel Castro was characterized by the African media. They saw him as a hero in a lot of ways. And as you may remember, at Nelson Mandela's funeral, Raul Castro gave a speech along with Obama. Yeah. Cuba was a big supporter of anti-apartheid, the anti-apartheid movement. So Cuba is seen in a lot of parts of the world as a sort of hero nation that stood up to U.S. imperialism. But, you know, so, yeah.
But that idea doesn't necessarily translate to how some expatriate Cubans living in Miami feel about their former country. Why are they still so angry? And is that breaking down on generational lines?
So, yeah, I mean, when the revolution happened in 1959, basically, you know, a lot of industries were nationalized. And U.S. Corporate interests were kicked out. And so a lot of people lost privilege and wealth in that process. And, you know, if you know, we're middle class and if we lost some of those privileges, we might also be upset about that. But on top of that, there were, you know, if you were seen as a political threat, there absolutely were violations of human rights during that process.
People were killed.
People were killed or arrested. And in that sense, I fully understand the sentiments of Miami Cubans. That history is hard to get over.
But that's an older generation that seems to be coming back with that kind of anger. It seems that from having heard what some younger Cubans are saying, they're almost at the point of saying, okay, enough already. It's time to normalize those relationships. Would that be true from what you've seen the people you talk to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the youngest of the exiles when they came from Cuba are now senior citizens. And so, for the younger generation in Miami, they are Americans. And they are involved in the national discussions that we have here. I'm not saying they're not affected by discussions, you know, related to Cuba, and they are deeply connected with the island, but not in the way that their parents and grandparents were.
But they are certainly very connected to the idea of having political prisoners exchanged for the possibility of having now a full diplomatic mission in Cuba.
Sure. I mean, I think if anything, the younger generations in Cuba want to be able to go there freely and establish their relationships on the island and have a little more freedom in that respect, and also help their families in it, you know, more easily. It's been incredibly difficult to send goods or money or things like that there. So, yeah.
We have just a minute left to talk, but as you look at the prospect of having full diplomatic ties to Cuba after all of these years of not and generations that have come and are going, this process is not a slam dunk by any means.
No, it's going to take some time to implement. In order for the internet to operate on the island, they'll need to install fiber optic cables. The bank infrastructure, in order for the banks to articulate with U.S. banks, it's going to take time to set that up. It might take up to a year.
And it's going to have to be able to go through the American government.
Well, this stuff, the bank, all the stuff I've just mentioned is you know, approved now under the executive order. But there are other, essentially the embargo is kind of a shell of what it was before. So it is a sweeping sort of change. Yeah, so but the final change in terms of our full freedom to go to the island, to go to Cuba, that will have to happen with the approval of Congress.
just to be able to whip out a credit card is going to take some doing.
Yes.
All right, Aisha, thank you for coming in. Aisha Nibe is an assistant professor of anthropology at Hawaii Pacific University. She's an associate scholar and member of the advisory board of the University of California Cuba Academic Initiative. That's an academic consortium of scholars who conduct research on Cuba. She's also the author of a chapter on Cuban internationalism in health travels, Cuban health care on and off island.
This is The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and coming up, for once, it actually is rocket science. But now, this morning's backyard quiz.
Later in the show, we'll be getting an update on the Pahoa lava flow from Brady Metcalf, the co-owner of Pahoa Auto Parts. But first, here's some Hawaii Island lava flow history for our backyard quiz. Now, on this day in 1986, both the Honolulu Advertiser and the New York Times reported that a molten lava flow from Kilauea had prompted evacuation orders in Kalapana. At the time the articles were published, the state had ordered the evacuation of about 50 families, or roughly 500 people, according to the Advertiser. Kilauea had been officially erupting since January 1983, but evacuations were only considered once lava reached the chain of craters road and other areas near to the Kalapana area in the days prior to December 19th. Over the next several days, lava caused significant damage and torched a number of homes. For today's quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us exactly how many homes were burned in Kalapana by Kilauea's 1986 lava flow. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you think you know the answer, and we'll tell you who gets it right later in the show.
Mele Kalikimaka and happy holidays. This is Jake Shimabukuro. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio.
The world of rocket science is generating renewed interest lately. Only yesterday, India launched its largest ever rocket into space. Private enterprise is getting into the act, and there's an increasing possibility that some of us, at least, will see a Mars mission in our lifetime. It's an exciting time to learn about rocketry, and instructor Cole Santos is offering a workshop next weekend that will take novice rocketeers from build to launch. He joins us by phone. Good morning, Cole.
Morning. How's it going?
All right. Do you get a feeling that we're in a kind of a resurgence of that Kennedy-era enthusiasm for rocketry that the country used to have?
We're definitely having another space race. You know, you got Elon Musk shooting rockets that are going to return to launch pads in the ocean. You know, the Chinese are finally getting along and really starting to do some advanced work in space. You've got lots of small workspaces that are creating and launching rockets and various, you know, stuff going into orbit. Even here at UH, there's a group that's building little CubeSats that they're going to launch on ballistic missiles out of Barking Sands in Kauai.
So it's a good time to learn some of the basics, yeah?
Absolutely. That's what we strive for. And, you know, we're going to do a launch and do some basic rocketry. But our goal in the long run is to create a, you know, a real community of people who are interested in science, technology, engineering, arts, and math.
And kind of in kind of how science works as well, yeah?
Right. There's, you know, that kind of, we try not to focus on that part. We try and focus on the fun. I think the rest of it just comes naturally.
But you do have to sort of, I mean, things get incredibly intricate before too long in rocketry, and you have to really have a grounding in fundamentals, don't you?
Right. Well, I think what actually happens is that as you build a project, you have to go out and find the knowledge that allows you to continue to build your project.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, that knowledge usually comes naturally with the project. And so what we're focusing on is more project-based education rather than you go out and learn all this stuff in books.
Yeah.
And you never get to launch a rocket.
That makes sense, because
then you launch the rocket first.
Yeah, yeah.
Then, with that interest, you go out and you go learn the science because you were interested in that rocket.
Well, what are the first things, given that, Cole? What are the first things that you need to learn, need to do?
Well, the first thing we do is we start everyone off with straw rockets. They're pretty fun.
Uh-huh.
You take a straw, put a little piece of clay on the end, and you shove it on our little machine that launches it. And our machine, you can calculate exactly how much air is coming out to launch the rocket. You can calculate the angle that it's at. And then we take kids, adults, and really everybody, and they have kind of a competition. And they say who can get their fins, the best kind of fins and the best, you know, amount of tape and amount of weight, and you really watch these kids do the science on their own. You know, they start with these giant elaborate fins, but they want to win. So by the end of the contest, they're chopping their fins down to the most aerodynamic possible shapes naturally without any instruction on what is aerodynamic.
Because they figure it out because the rocket doesn't go very far, or it crashes on launch or whatever. If the balance is wrong, or the fins, as you say, are too large, it's going to get too much wind resistance. It's not going to fly very well.
Exactly.
So that's you just kind of figure that out. You kind of figure that out intuitively. It's like, well, that thing just crashed into the ground, so it's probably too heavy, that kind of thing, right?
Exactly. And that's, you know, exactly goes with kind of our mission, is that science should be intuitive, not, you know, some abstract thing off in the distance that's this castle that you can never get to.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense, and especially when you look at the people who came upon the very first scientific principles, going back to, you know, Aristotle or Isaac Newton, they weren't really calculating. They were kind of dreaming and thinking in very broad terms, yeah?
Right. They were all philosophers. You know, they were men who did everything. You know, they were math, they were science, they were cooks, they were tinkerers. They just did cool stuff. They spent their days searching their curiosity, their desires. They were living their life to the fullest. And because of that, they created amazing, you know, technology that builds everything we have today.
Very, very free minds in the case of just about any innovator you can think of, yeah?
Right, and that's what we want to do at Maui Makers, is we want to create free minds.
Well, it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. But and then acquiring that understanding of the scientific method through trial and error, lots of trial and error, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, you can get the book science at school, but we're hoping to get you interested in that book science at school, you know, to get kids interested in going in the engineering fields. You know, we have a problem where people aren't as interested in the engineering fields as they used to be. And so we're trying to change that because, you know, a lot of us are interested, and we need to share that passion with younger people, or we're not going to have any engineers.
Well, finding a way to make it enjoyable seems like a pretty good pathway, Cole. And I thank you for taking the time this morning.
Yep, thank you.
Good luck with your workshop.
All right, you too. Have a good one.
Cole Santos will offer an introduction to rocketry Saturday, December 27th, 2014, at the Kihei Elementary School across the street from Kihei Community Center, starting at 10 a.m. Details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering the exceptional checking account, which includes an identity theft protection package that alerts users if personal information is compromised. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
I'm Ira Flatto. On the next Science Friday, we'll talk about another Mars mystery, newly discovered methane. What does it mean for life on the red planet? Plus, science comes under political attack.
There's a double-edged sword to trying to make science more accessible.
Scientists and their funding under fire. All on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
HPR listeners from around the islands and well beyond responded with enthusiasm, first-time gifts, and renewals during our B-Side project. Mahalo to Tracy Crow Jones of Honolulu, Beth Halpern of Kihei, and Jennifer Nakata of Honolulu, and Jeffrey Polovina of Kailua for their contributions last week. Increasing HPR support base is vital to the station's mission of community building and sustained growth. You too can make your end-of-the-year donation today. You can call us at 955-8821 during business hours or donate online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from Ballet Hawaii, announcing The Nutcracker, with guest artists from the New York City Ballet accompanied by the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday at the Blaisdell Concert Hall, ballethawaii.org.
It's a big story, and it appears it will cost even bigger dollars. Honolulu's rail project will make the taxpayers dig a little deeper than originally planned. The project is on track to add over half a billion, with a B, dollars to the price tag. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Friday, Beth Ann.
You too, but not so much to everyone who heard yesterday that this is going to cost us a bundle more than we thought it was going to be.
Might actually be as much as $700 million. Remember, this is already on top of a $5.2 billion price tag, so we're getting in the almost $6 billion right now, and officials blamed a number of reasons for that. One was a couple of lawsuits that has delayed the project. Another is lag in tax collections. But there were also higher than expected construction bids. So Dan Grabowskis, who runs the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation, said a little belt tightening is going to have to happen, but also looking for other sources of revenue.
Weren't there supposed to be some of safeguards in there in case there were to be cost overruns or delays or other things, so that we wouldn't have to go a little deeper in our pockets to be able to pay for this?
You know,
I kind of remember that conversation way back when.
One example is there is the $210 million in federal funds that goes to the bus system here, but Mayor Caldwell made clear yesterday that that's not going to happen, that you have to consider rail and the bus separately. So that was considered a cushion, but that's not going to happen. What seems to be a real possibility is to extend that surcharge on the general excise tax, the 0.5% that we here on Oahu pay. The rest of the islands don't have to pay for that. The rail is not on their island. There's talk of extending that past the year 2022, when it was supposed to sunset, when it is supposed to sunset.
Or perhaps lifting the sunset altogether.
I mean, one would hope they would only extend it a little while longer, but we're talking about a big chunk of change here. You know, the Federal Transit Administration has been warning HART for months now that it needed to be more aggressive about cost containment measures if they wanted to stay within budget. But some things just caught people by surprise. One big thing was the recent station construction bid that came in 60% higher than they expected. Well, there's $110 million right there. Another thing that actually caught me by surprise is because of all the development that's happening in Kaka'ako, apparently that's cut into the contractor pool that HART can reach out to, and that has driven up prices. So a number of factors contributing to the increase in the rail project.
But as they're trying to contain some of those costs, part of the strategy, at least from what we heard yesterday, was also to look at breaking down some of the component parts even more than they've been put out to bid now, and to then put them out for another bid. What will that really do?
You know, I don't know. There's going to be a lot more scrutiny of the project. Of course, critics of the rail, and by the way, that sound in the background is the windows being cleaned outside of Civil Beat, so please do not be alarmed by the noise that you're hearing. But I can tell you that Dan Grabowska said, you know, we may have to consider other things as well. Maybe we ought to start looking at that Manoa extension now, talking about that conversation, having the rail line extend from Ala Moana Center to the University of Hawaii.
Well, some people may be very happy about that. Others are going to turn away, shake their heads, and I can already see the eye roll. We'll talk more about this as it continues to develop. Have a good weekend, Chad. We'll talk to you next week. Actually, I won't till I get back, but we'll talk to you soon.
I'll be talking to Chris then.
You will. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye, Bethan.
Chad Blair is a political reporter for CivilBeat.com. We have to stop dancing now. All right, fine. As you know, on a Friday, we always take a look at what's coming up in the next week for our news department. Bill Dorman, HPR's news director, is in the studio with me now. Well, next week, we know some of the big things that are happening. We've got a lot of holiday making.
They tell me it's holiday time. You know, Christmas next week, New Year's week after that, and still, apparently, a lot of last-minute shoppers out there.
Oh, you think?
Well, me among them. But a lot of times, people will ask, and actually ask us in the news department, believe it or not, about options that are locally made. You know, how are local merchants doing? How are our local craftsmen doing? And how do you go about, if you're interested in buying local in a holiday kind of way, how do you do that and what's available? And so Noe Tanigawa is going to step back and take a look at some of these. A lot of these may be familiar to our listeners, but she's got a couple of things that are a couple of new discoveries as well on the gift front.
Oh, good, because there are a few people I know
could use that suggestion, or two.
But not only just made in Hawaii, but sometimes at stores that are local only to Hawaii.
Exactly.
I mean, looking at how things are distributed in a store that may be here and elsewhere, as well as a smaller boutique or at the craft fair. I mean, where would we be without craft fairs?
Well, and as with retail everywhere, you know, the holiday season is such a big part of that annual business that when it comes to, again, supporting local and supporting the folks who are making an extra effort to do things locally, that's, you know, it's an important opportunity to bear in mind.
Well, I hope she's doing that report earlier in the week.
Yeah, exactly. That'll be Monday, as a matter of fact. But also, we have other gift-giving fronts. You know, we're following the voyage of the Hokulea, as you know, and the crew will remain in New Zealand over the holidays. But in the theme of gift-giving, the holiday season, the Hokulea folks have an interesting perspective because they brought a number of gifts with them, some culturally significant items and some other things. One of the side stories of the trip are the set of gift exchanges that have been going on. And so Molly Solomon is going to take a look at that as part of her weekly or semi-weekly look at the Hokulea. And a familiar funny man returning to the islands, Bill Maher, back with what has turned into a bit of a tradition for him, coming to Honolulu for the holidays or for New Year's Eve. As you know, politics, humor, boy, there's a lot of material for him to work with. And he talked with Dave Lawrence about some of the political insanity going on. And so that'll be something to look forward to next week.
Well,
as well.
A number of gifts for all of us in the holiday week. Thank you very much.
You bet.
And I won't see you next week. So.
And happy holidays.
Well, happy holidays to you, too.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
On the next Radio Lab.
Going to Galapagos is like going to Mecca.
Is the place that taught us about evolution.
Green mangroves, black lava flows, pink flamingos.
Wow. Now a harbinger for the end of nature.
We're radically remaking the world.
That forest was 100% gone.
And how far are we willing to go to save it?
We're God. We might as well get good at it.
Galapagos on the next Radio Lab.
Saturday morning at 10. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital, Infinity of Honolulu, and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
Six months into the lava flow, Paho Marketplace may very soon feel its impact. At last night's community meeting, residents and business owners were told lava could reach the marketplace sometime around next Wednesday. Leading Edge is about half a mile from the shopping center and just under a mile from the intersection of Highway 130 and Pahoa Village Road. Yesterday, residents also heard from Governor David Ige following his tour of the lava flow, schools, and the Pahoa Marketplace merchants. He's pledged state support for the community, but what the community will need will be determined by what actually happens and when. Amid all of that uncertainty, many business owners are trying to stay open as long as they can. Brady Metcalf would be one of them. He's the co-owner of Pahoa Auto Parts, and he joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
This morning, as you look out from your business, what are you seeing?
Well, it's kind of a great day in Pahoa in more ways than one. I mean, yesterday, the Malama Marketplace did shut down about 90% of their businesses. I think Pahoa Fresh Fish is the only one, or maybe Pahoa Propane might be the only two that are still open and operational. Everybody else, the big chains, Ace Hardware and the Marketplace closed up and laid off their employees, and you know, they have National Guard over there in the parking lot to keep people from, you know, clogging the area up in the event that the lava actually gets there anytime soon.
And what about for you?
Well, we're not that far away. I mean, I could hit a golf ball to the Marketplace parking lot from my business. And my house is right next to my business, so I'm faced with the task of trying to, if it comes down to where civil defense gives us the evacuation order, you know, I have to pack up my business and my home and figure out where I'm going from here. But right now, we're just, you know, it's uncertain, but all we can do is keep doing what we're doing and keep, you know, serving the community with what we do. And that's our plan until they give us a eviction notice, evacuation notice.
So how has business been?
Well, it's been steady. We sell, a lot of people are fixing up older vehicles to get them out of here and then have things to move more of their belongings out. And then we had the good fortune to have that front page story on the Tribune Herald about the lava go with the flow T-shirts we've been selling here. And that just, it got picked up by the Associated Press and went ballistic. We're getting calls from all over the United States for these T-shirts. So I think we're selling more T-shirts than we are auto parts at this point.
That's some great press.
Well, it's amazing how things work sometimes.
Not for the reason that you would like, but
yeah, well,
really trying to take, as they say, that lemon and turn it into lemonade, or at least in this case, a T-shirt.
Well, life gives you lemons, make margaritas.
Yeah, well, that too. Preferably later in the day than right now. But for you, as you're looking at next Wednesday, which is also Christmas Eve, and you have a house next to your shop, as you mentioned, so it gives you sort of a double whammy. At what point will you say, maybe we just ought to go anyway, whether or not they tell you that it's time to evacuate?
Well, the only thing that might change that, or two factors, are depending on, as the lava approaches Highway 130, where they put up the civil defense roadblocks will affect, traffic in and out of our business. And also, if the forest or whatever behind Malama Market started burning and there was a lot of smoke in the air and it became, you know, unsafe to be here, then we would pack up and leave. But until that point, I mean, I really don't have any place else to go. Pahoa is my home, and it has been for about 30 years now. So, you know, I'm not like, you know, Long's Drugs that has three locations that can just relocate their employees and merchandise to other stores, and Ace Hardware, the same thing. We have one location, and it's in Pahoa, so that's where we're staying.
Which means the stakes are higher for you. So, Brady, what will you do? Do you have any plan that you're working on now so that it just doesn't hit you all at once when they give you potentially an evacuation notice and say you have to go?
Well, we're looking around to see if there's any other commercial property in the area. But, I mean, the problem is so is everyone from Malama Marketplace that's been displaced. I mean, if the lava doesn't come right through the parking lot and it's to the point where they can go back and open their businesses in a week or a month, then we're okay. But, I mean, everybody's kind of scrambling to find a new home. And, you know, our thing is we'll look around and see what's available. We have plans to warehouse some of our inventory and merchandise. And, you know, again, as far as the business goes, we're going to stay here. And, you know, our people are, we're a small business. You know, we have like 5 employees. You know, our guys are here to the end. So, I mean.
And they've told you that we're staying with you no matter what happens. And we either all go together or we don't.
That's it. I mean, but the unemployment people came by yesterday going door to door through Pahoa. That was kind of surreal. I mean, usually that doesn't happen, but you know, they're coming around looking for people to sign up now.
Which is not something that you're used to having happen there.
Not at all. But like I say, it's the whole thing with, I mean, all the infrastructure that we've waited 30 years to get, you know, the Malama Market area, the Long's Drugs, the gas, new gas stations, everything, all that's being pretty much yanked out from under our feet, and we're going back 30 years in time to, you know, old Pahoa, which for the time being is safe because of the lava field comes to the northeast pretty much, and, you know, there's a ridge from where the original flow came into town right by Alfred Lee's berm that kind of insulates the old 100-year-old Pahoa town from the new developed end of town.
Is there any place that you feel that you, if you had to go, that you would go? I mean, you said that your home is there as well as your business, and that is a unique position for, at least from, you know, what we hear of the people who have businesses there. You're right next to it, so it's going to take you out all in one whack if that happens. Do you have a place of safety even for short term that you would go?
Oh, yeah, I have a couple places I could go, and I'm not really over. I mean, worrying doesn't help anything. All you can do is figure out, okay, what am I going to take with me? What do I leave behind? And once you've made that decision, it's pretty much just day-to-day and watch the situation. And, you know, again, if it calls for it, then pack up what you've decided to take out, and the rest of it's expendable. I mean,
and you already know what goes on each of those lists, what's expendable and what you absolutely have to take with you.
Oh, I'm taking stuff like, you know, family photos and personal items. I mean,
and you've got that stuff ready to go.
Oh yeah, it's boxed up and ready. I mean,
okay, so
it has been for a while.
When you said pack up and go, I wasn't quite sure whether you meant that you were really on the way to being able just to pick it up and go with it, or whether you were starting kind of from scratch. So you know that you could go, if they gave you an evacuation order tomorrow, you could actually pick up and go, and you would know exactly what you were going to take and that you'd be satisfied.
Well, they said they would give us 3 to 4 days notice. Hopefully they'll be able to do that. I mean, the lava, right now it's kind of slowing down because it's hitting less of a grade as it approaches Malama Market. But if it got into that trench on our side of it, there's a drainage there that, when it gets into these confined areas, it can just run really quick. And
it can go really quickly.
Move a quarter mile a day, you know, instead of the, you know, 70 yards or 170. But, yeah, I've got, you know, I'm not completely packed up because I'm not completely sure that we're going to get displaced. But
no, it's really tough to be caught in that very uncertain place and to be there for such a long time. Brady, we wish you all the best coming into a holiday week, one that we hope that will mean that it will slow down a little bit for you and give you at least enough time to do what you've already set out to do, or perhaps maybe not even have to go.
Well, like I say, the community will be here even if the town is gone. So, yeah, well, you guys have a Merry Christmas, because, like I say, it'll be what it is. But, you know, like I say, worrying doesn't help, and all you can do is prepare hope for the best and prepare for the worst.
Well, that's true. And also send all best wishes your way. Thanks very much for talking to us this morning.
Mahalo.
Brady Metcalf is the co-owner of Pahoa Auto Parts. He and other merchants are waiting and watching the lava flow.
Now that we've gotten an update on the current status of the lava flow in Pahoa, let's get back to this morning's backyard quiz. On today's date in 1986, the Honolulu Advertiser and the New York Times reported that a molten lava flow from Kilauea had prompted the issuance of evacuation orders to residents in Kalapana. At the time those articles were published, the state had ordered an evacuation of about 500 people, as reported by the local paper. Kilauea had officially begun erupting on January 3, 1983, but evacuations were only issued once lava reached Chain of Crater Road and other areas next to Kalapana in the days leading up to December 19th. Over the course of the next several days, lava caused significant damage to the area and engulfed a number of homes. For today's quiz, we're wondering if you could tell us how many homes were burned in Kalapana by the 1986 lava flow. And the answer is 17 homes. It's 8:47, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Nohea Gallery at Ward Warehouse, offering original art and handcrafted gifts for giving and for home. Local artists, island style. Open daily 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. NoheaGallery.com.
Ideally, the holidays are a celebration of the best in ourselves, and that's something most of us discover through what we do for others. Volunteers often tell you the rewards they got back from a little selfless effort made it all worthwhile. And that's a dynamic you see played out again and again at places like the Haku Baldwin Center in upcountry Maui, where volunteers take children with special needs from 12 to 18 years of age for rides on horseback. The therapeutic riding sessions have a healing effect on all concerned, and Program Assistant Director Chrissy Stout is on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Chrissy.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Therapeutic riding is a good name for it, because there is something about getting that huge animal to work with you that, it has quite an effect, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And just a quick correction, we take children ages 2 to 18, so we take the little ones as well.
Oh, what did I say? Anyway, yeah, 2 to 18.
Instead of 12. Yeah.
Oh.
So the very active sitting on the horse provides three-dimensional movement, so up and down, back and forth, side to side, kind of movement that no other activity. Strengthen core muscles for the children, and from there we can help strengthen the rest of the body. Sometimes it's the warmth of the horse that can warm up the rider's muscles, and it can also have a big calming effect on the children. And the horses that we take have to have a calm demeanor, of course. They have to be physically sound, and they have to like their job, which is usually the case here.
That doesn't seem like too much to ask, does it?
That's right. You must like your job. And all of our therapy horses at Haku Baldwin Center are sweet and gentle, and everyone seems to have their favorite, too.
Well, Chrissy, I like what you said about that movement going in all different directions at once, because for one thing, and anybody who's been on a horse knows, it requires a heightened alertness.
It does, definitely. So if every rider that we have in our program learns some measure of riding and horsemanship skills, just like a regular lesson, and we teach them to the best of their ability. Our riding sessions take place in a normal equine environment, and the sessions are augmented with different therapeutic games and activities based on the needs and abilities of each child. And we definitely try to focus on what the kids can do rather than what they can't do based on their disability or diagnosis. And there definitely seems to be a carryover of the positive effects. We have reports from parents that they have better communication skills at home, and we get reports from teachers in classrooms. For one example, for children who have language and communication issues, they know that the horse needs a special command in order for it to move. So until they say, walk on, Apache, the horse will stay. But the second it sees the correct command, the horse moves. So the child makes the connection that communication gets me what I want. So we definitely hear great feedback from parents and teachers alike.
Part of that communication with a horse is intuitive, because if you're tense, they're going to know it, right?
Exactly. The horse can, and people who ride horses, adults and children alike, can tell you that the horse can then mirror your emotions or your reactions to things. They're very intuitive. They do command, like walk on and whoa, but they read our energy like you wouldn't believe. And we have a new program that we started up recently, a horsemanship for veterans program. And it's based on the fact that it's all about using your energy and your body language to communicate with the horse. And we received such great feedback from veterans, including that it helps with their anxiety and it gives them something really great to look forward to each week.
I know you're not currently, you don't currently have a call out for volunteers, but periodically throughout the year you do ask for volunteers, right?
We do, definitely. Yes. In all of our programs, we have volunteer opportunities. We have some starting up in just. If anyone wants information about volunteering with us, you can go to our website, hospitalcenter.org.
Chrissy, I'm having trouble with your cell phone reception. Can you move to just move somewhere so we can see if we can hear you a little better?
Sure. Is this better?
No, it's worse. So we'll dial you in just a second. But try me again there, Chrissy.
Okay. So if anyone wants information about our volunteer programs, they can visit our website, hakubaldwincenter.org/volunteer, and we have all the information on there.
We'll send them your way, Chrissy. What I wanted to ask about was what kind of tasks you're going to need.
Sure. So for the animal-assisted therapy program, for example, we take our therapy animals to facilities around Maui. So everyone helps load up the animals and take them to facilities and interact with seniors and patients of all ages in facilities. For the therapeutic riding program, for each child, we have a team of 3 volunteers and 1 instructor. So they're walking beside the child and either holding on to them or just being there for safety. And the horsemanship for veterans program, we have people that help with horse care and making sure we have everything we need for each session.
So not a lot of prior knowledge required. You sort of will train.
All training is provided. And even for the therapeutic horseback riding program, we have quarterly training sessions, and we have one coming up in January, too. All you need is a love for animals and a love for people, and we have opportunities that kind of meet everyone's needs. We do have an age minimum, so you have to be 16 years of age to volunteer with us.
Fair enough, Chrissy. Good to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
You bet. Chrissy Stout is the assistant director of the Therapeutic Riding Program and the Horsemanship for Veterans Program at the Haku Baldwin Center in Makawao, Maui. And you can learn more about the center on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Oh, Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Justine Willis-Toms. Next time on New Dimensions, we'll be featuring a talk I gave in the summer of 2014 about thriving in chaotic times.
Sunday morning at 11.
Beth-Ann, you're an equestrian. You can speak to the effect that horses have on people and that people have on horses, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. You'll get no argument from me that my favorite people to be around are usually the four-legged variety. They stand about, I know, 17 hands tall.
When it comes to being intuitive about what someone is feeling, the state of mind that a person is in, horses can teach humans quite a bit, don't you think?
Well, again, you get no argument from me on that one. There were many, many afternoons I spent out there with my horse telling my troubles to her and feeling that she was the only one who would understand. And they are such empathic creatures that she would know just when to come over and just sort of hang her head over my shoulder. So what these animals do for children who need them for therapeutic purposes, actually, I think it goes both ways. I think the animal also knows that it's really, truly helping a human being.
Well, I really feel that everyone should have an opportunity to ride, because when you feel that sense of a connection through, for want of a better term, vibrations that you're sending out, it really completes something in people, I think.
Riding and then also having to care for the animal, too. It's not just a matter of getting off and off you go.
Yeah.
But, I can say that now because I don't have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and muck out that stable.
That's right.
Maybe life would be different if I still had to do that, too. Anyway, we hope that they get the volunteers that they need to help the kids who really need it.
Yeah.
And we're going to wish you a very happy Holly's Leaves. I'm going to, because I'm going to be away for the next couple of weeks. And long ago, HPR staffer Liza Simon is going to be here. So we hope you have a couple of good conversations with her, too.
Oh, yeah. And on the agenda, a film about North Korea, Life as a North Korean Defector, and a virtual tour of the Biodiversity Trail at the National Botanical Garden.
All this time, you can certainly let us in on your radio talk back. You can find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation. Or if you want to get to me even over the next couple of weeks, you can find me on Twitter at BKOZHPR.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. Our executive producer is Beth-Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant.
And the Backyard Quiz theme by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkuhl.
I'm Beth-Ann Kozlovich. Come back on Monday and pick up the conversation. Happy holidays.